Hello and welcome to Governance Uncovered, a podcast brought to you by the Governance and Local Development Institute at the University of Gothenburg. This podcast is supported by the Swedish Research Council. In this episode, we are joined by Egor Lasrev, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Yale University. Egor and host Ellen Lust discussed Egor's book State Building as Lawfare, Custom Sharia and State Law in Post-War Chechnya, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2023. The book addresses two interrelated puzzles. Why do local rulers tolerate and even promote non-state legal systems at the expense of state law? And why do some members of repressed ethnic minorities choose to resolve their everyday disputes using state legal systems instead of non-state alternatives? It documents how rulers of Chechnya promote and reinvent customary law and Sharia in order to borrow legitimacy from tradition and religion, increase autonomy from the metropole, and accommodate communal authorities and former rebels. At the same time, the book shows how prolonged armed conflict disrupted the traditional social hierarchies and pushed some Chechen women to use state law, spurring state formation from below. As Ellen and Egor discuss the book, they get into how Egor first became interested in working in Chechnya and on issues of legal pluralism, individual-level decision-making, and whether Egor believes that the book's perspective on the state as fragmented, always including centers and peripheries, extends to other contexts than the one of Chechnya and Russia. We hope that you will find this episode interesting, and let's get into it.
Thank you, Egor, for joining us today. It's exciting to talk to you about your book, and congratulations on it. A very fascinating read, actually, about what you call state lawfare in Chechnya. So I want to begin by asking you just to give us a sense, first of all, of how you became interested in working in Chechnya, and particularly on issues of legal pluralism.
Ellen, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm very excited about this conversation, and I'm very excited that you read the book, because the authors of academic books, we never know if anyone would read them. So I'm very excited to have such a reader as you. So my interest in the North Caucasus was sparked by reading one book by sociologist Georgi Drulgyan. He wrote this book, For Your Secret Admirer in the Caucasus. And I read this book. It's a pretty thick book, and I read it overnight, and I was really fascinated by the region, by its ethnic, religious, political complexities and diversities, and decided to go to Republic of Dagestan when I was still an undergrad studying in St. Petersburg. And so this was the fall of 2010, and I kind of surprised my family and all my friends by going there, spent there a few weeks, which were really fascinating. And since then, I've been going to the North Caucasus repeatedly for many years. I was spent some time doing research in Dagestan, in North Ossetia, in Kabardino-Balkaria, and ultimately decided to do my dissertation work on Chechnya. This was primarily a political decision. I thought that we know very little about this very politically important region, that its representation is really dominated by stereotypes about terrorism, about violence, and society really went through kind of horrific political violence, but we know very little of what is happening on the ground. And so I decided to do a study for my dissertation, spent several years studying Chechnya. And when I came to the field, I didn't plan to study legal pluralism or law. If anything, I always thought that law is a very boring subject. So I came to Chechnya to study the politics of Sufi Islam, which I also kind of discovered while doing research in the North Caucasus, and ultimately spent several months talking to Sufi sheikhs, their followers, talking to politicians, and I was totally convinced that they do have a very important political role. But because Sufi Islam has its secretive nature, it was very hard to study it systematically. But while I was studying it and while I was doing this research, I kind of discovered the topic of legal pluralism in the field. I was interviewing a prominent religious authority in the southern Dagestan, and I observed, I was trying to ask him questions about religion and politics, and he allowed me to sit in his mosque for basically the entire day, and I observed how people would come and go constantly to to him to resolve their disputes related to car accidents, debt, family relations. And for me as a political scientist, this was a completely novel thing. I had no idea how to think about this. So I came back to New York, started reading, and discovered this is a very important topic on legal pluralism. So that's how I ended up studying it.
That's great. Well, you're absolutely right. It's both an important topic. And one of the things I think that you make the point in the book about is the fact that the reality is that most of us, wherever we are, don't resolve disputes and often don't finalize and adjudicate things within state court. A lot of sort of activity takes place outside of state courts, right? And that, in a sense, that's more the norm than it is an exception. I mean, in this case, you're talking about what you call adat or a customary law, as well as about Sharia or sort of religious law and then state law. And those are the kind of the three, what I would think of as competing systems or competing legal bases that you're looking at. Can you give us just a little bit more sense of what each of those looks like, what they're comprised of in Chechnya?
Yes, I mean, first of all, you're absolutely right that going to state courts is a kind of a nuclear option for, you know, basically every society. You know, I'm talking to you from the U.S., and you know, there's this image of U.S. as being a very litigious society, but even in the U.S., you know, only a very tiny fraction of disputes end up in state courts. Basically, the entirety of post-colonial world, legal pluralism is very much the norm, and in many countries we hear, and many social contexts, there is the same constellation of legal orders. So the state law, religious law, and customary or traditional law. In the context of the North Caucasus, de jure, only state law exists and recognized. So this is like a statutory state legal system, very much similar to many other continental legal systems in Europe and elsewhere in the world, affected by European legal tradition. Customary law is indigenous to the North Caucasus. The main principle of customary law is that basically a collective system of responsibility. So the subject of law is not an individual, but a family or extended family, the clan. And so it was developed outside of state regulation. So all the regulations are based on this collective relations between families. That's why the ultimate regulator is the custom of blood revenge, that, you know, you use violence to resolve disputes, but mostly it's, you know, it's the system of regulation of every sphere of life developed in the pre-Islamic period in Chechnya and preserved despite the Islamization of the region. And Sharia law emerged obviously with Islamization of the region and became one of the most important regulators of social life during the anti-colonial struggle in the 19th century during the long Caucasian War, when at some point Chechnya was part of the Islamic State organized by the leader of anti-colonial resistance, and since then also persisted in different forms in the region. And as a result, yes, today we have this system where de jure is only state law, the Russian state law, but de facto the legal orders based on custom and religion are very powerful and very much present in everyday life.
And you give some fascinating examples, right, of where people try to essentially kind of force the hand of others by getting them to rely, for example, on customary law, right? And remember, one of the powerful examples for me was where you have somebody who wants to get married, and so they kidnap the bride, which by customary law, in terms of preserving honor, would lead to a forced marriage. And then they find that the family actually doesn't force the marriage the way they wanted to, and instead actually sort of goes through other options. So this idea of people kind of strategizing or second guessing what others would rely on, and therefore what would happen in particular instances, right? Which raises this question of the individual level, what types of, if you have forum shopping, was how people often talk about this, right? That individuals know that they can either go to the religious authority or they can use customary law or they can try to go to the state. In those kinds of contexts, people will make a decision of where to go. What can you tell us about the individual level decision making over what fora people use?
Yeah, no, when I first started studying this, I thought that this is very interesting because, you know, how does society function when there are multiple alternative rules of the game? So again, for social scientists, this creates a very interesting puzzle. And for a long time, I thought, you know, how can we study these individual choices, everyday choices that people make? And I thought that the evidence I collected and through kind of thinking about different theories that might help us to make sense of this, I decided to contrast the normative forces based on ideological or identity-based attachment to either a religion, which is a very powerful factor, or identity-based attachment to customary law as an expression of ethnic identity or national identity as one force, and then as strategic calculation based on expectation of favorability of an outcome as the main kind of counterbalance. That's basically in the decisions about legal systems, very much like in other important political decisions, there's always this balance between strategic calculations and normative calculations. But the normative calculations are also connected to what you've mentioned about the role of enforcement, that in unlike in state system where there's kind of systematic enforcement, specialized enforcement, in non-state legal systems, in this case customary law and Sharia, is very much based on the role of social pressure. And so the social pressure is very strongly connected to this normative attachment and expectation, so it always have to be on people's mind. There are other factors like costs and experience with judicial system, but I think in most general terms, we can think of it through this normative versus instrumental considerations and factors.
So can you link that for me to the idea that one of the impacts of the conflict has been kind of the disruption of social hierarchies? Because you actually make what I think is a very interesting case that gender is the main cleavage. We often think of cleavages around class, but that gender becomes a main cleavage. And you describe how the war itself disrupts gender balances and disrupts the balance of power between genders, I should say. So how has that then affected the extent to which those in Chechnya or those in Dagestan or elsewhere would or would not decide to take things to the state courts versus, for example, Sharia or Adat?
Yeah, this line of reasoning about gender and transformation of gender relations in Chechnya became one of the main findings of my study. And my interpretation of what I found is that this conflict, a long-lasting conflict in Chechnya, led to profound transformation of gender relations and social hierarchies more generally. So basically in every sphere, in terms of generational hierarchies, social cohesion of communities, and altogether, this kind of disruption of social hierarchies diminished the effectiveness of social pressure. And social pressure does play a truly important role in terms of expectations, in terms of actual kind of ostracism or using pressure on those members of communities that decide to go to state courts. And I found that in Chechnya overall, but especially in the most victimized communities, these hierarchies in terms of gender, in terms of age, in terms of cohesion of communities diminished as a result of the Second Chechen War, which created conditions for women or other kind of marginalized members of the communities for whom state law is better to go to state courts. So it is very much about the role of social pressure and as a factor of enforcement and as a factor in choosing between state and non-state legal systems.
Which is especially interesting because I guess my thinking about it was, on the one hand, gender, obviously, gender imbalances and this idea that state courts are often seen as a better fora for women than customary or religious ones are. That's kind of a longstanding set of expectations, right? But then when you really think about that vis-a-vis something like class, I mean, what's interesting to me is that in the gender relations, these are often very within household relations that we're often talking about, right? So the social pressure aspect of it can be arguably even higher than it can be if we're thinking about cross-class cleavages. So this idea that the nature of the cleavage in itself may shape differently, turning to state courts versus others or kind of reliance on the state, I think is a really interesting concept and worth thinking even more about than the cases that you have here, right? I think there's a lot of really interesting lessons and questions that emerge from that. So I was excited to see that. I was also really intrigued by your argument that we have a second level of contestation that takes place, or a second level of decision-making, right? Which is really about what local leaders are doing. So you basically say, okay, if you're a local leader, you can either try to suppress the non-state systems, or you can try to accommodate it, or else you can actually even at times attempt to promote it. Can you say a little bit more about when leaders take these different decisions and what it looks like when they do?
Yes, I mean, I tried to chase two questions in this study, in this one book, one about individual choices between state and non-state legal systems, and also about politicians with particular focus on local leaders and their policies towards state and non-state legal systems. And in general, it's a terrible idea to pursue two questions in one study, in one article or one book. But for me, you know, I always thought that, you know, these questions are interrelated. And even though it was difficult to try to address them both, I thought I should try to do it. And so the whole process for me was, in terms of writing, was how to merge these two perspectives, these two analytical levels. And I was studying why do some local leaders who are technically representatives of the state promote non-state legal systems. So in the case of Chechnya, and some neighboring regions, they were local political leaders who were bureaucrats of the Russian state, the Russian state officials, but they were promoting customary law and Sharia at the expense of state law. And for me, this was one of the major puzzles. In general, we can think of the strategies of local political leaders in terms of their relation to non-state legal systems, either through this promotion, suppression, or tolerance, or kind of non-intervention. And I was thinking about different factors that would determine this policy. And I think the most obvious factors, the ones that I also read insightful analysis about in the literature, were the role of state capacity, that in some places, leaders, state officials just don't have resources to regulate everyday life and everyday disputes, and so they don't intervene there. There's the powerful ideological considerations that some political leaders driven by, for example, you know, communist ideology want to get rid of non-state legal systems as rudiments of the past, those really traditions to get rid of. Or in contrast, there were ideology of multiculturalism and diversity that tried to promote these different manifestations of culture, for example. And in my analysis, I really emphasized political considerations, considerations of establishing local political control through legitimation, through coalition building, and also through getting autonomy from the metropole, from the center of the state, by promoting legal pluralism and making basically themselves indispensable to the center. In this case of Chechnya, I was studying how local political leaders, and especially Ramzan Kadyrov, were promoting non-state legal systems to make this boundary control from Moscow.
I have a question on the boundary control aspect, because one way to think about that is that they just want to have more power. So it has the same impact or the same importance as legitimation does in coalition building, because those are all ways in which the leader gains power vis-a-vis the center. The other way, though, which is a slightly different interpretation, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it, is that there's also a translation element, that when it comes to thinking about custom and particularly customary law, that there may be ways in which understanding the local interpretations puts the local leader a particular advantage vis-a-vis the metropole, which they don't have necessarily if they are thinking about people only engaging with regards to sort of state law. And you could even argue that there's enough variation in terms of way something like Sharia is interpreted, that local knowledge actually makes that much more difference. In your view, is this simply another way of gaining support and therefore power because you've essentially accommodated or allowed these other interpretations? Or is it also, is there an information and kind of a knowledge and specialization aspect to it that's important?
My interpretation is that this story is about power and about autonomy. But I really like your metaphor of translation. You know, I would represent my argument like when actually the absence of translation, that political leaders in Chechnya, they all speak Russian. And so imagine a meeting between some kind of Kremlin official and the leaders of Chechnya, and they can speak in Russian and basically speak in the language of the metropole here. But they can also start conversation in Chechen, and by doing that, completely puzzle this state officials in Moscow because they do not speak Chechen. And so by promoting customary law in Sharia, in effect, if you push this metaphor, they are speaking Chechen to Moscow and making Moscow uncomfortable because, you know, Moscow doesn't know how to deal with customary law, with blood revenge, with bride kidnappings. For them, these are like things that they don't want to think about. They don't want to hear about them. And so by publicly promoting it and establishing institutions, they're creating this kind of invisible wall between Chechnya and Moscow.
just fascinating, right? I mean, if you think about what that means and the relative power and how you as a local leader can try to extend it, it's actually really, really fascinating. I'm wondering what we think about when we're trying to take that to argument to places where we don't have this kind of metropole periphery or metropole local relationship. I mean, you talk about it in terms of empire. How far do you think your argument travels to places where that center and periphery is at least not in the same shape as it is between Chechnya and Russia? Or should we think that we always have center and peripheries, even in the U.S., for instance?
Yeah, no, this condition of what they call nested sovereignty, kind of empires or kind of neo-colonial settings, contemporary Chechnya and Russia, I think this setting is quite widespread, and we can think of, you know, many peripheries in the post-colonial world. If we think just of a nation state and focus on a nation state, in many post-colonial countries still have this kind of semi-colonial relationship of dependence from, in this case, global center, not the center of a country, but the global center, the West, and some of these practices like polygamy or other practices which are seen to be sensitive and where the West, for example, tries to get rid of them or pressures the government to like regulate them differently. There's this bargaining is also present. To what degree you want to build your national legal system purely on Western standards, so you want to incorporate indigenous elements, religious elements, customary elements, and your interpretations of them, right? Because there's wide variety of how can you organize customary law and what does it mean? And this variety gives this political space for this type of boundary control. There is also, this question is relevant for the U.S. Actually, the concept of boundary control was developed by scholar Edward Gibson in studying authoritarian enclaves in Latin America and the U.S., like, you know, the Deep South throughout much of the 20th century. And you can also think of indigenous communities in the U.S. and their complex relationship with the U.S. federal government in terms of the sovereignty, in terms of autonomy, in terms of the use of legal systems, like whether you can apply criminal law, for example, for non-indigenous perpetrators of violence against women in reservations in the U.S. This is a very politically important subject. So this bargaining and establishment of boundary in the context of nested sovereignty like the U.S. is a very important question that I don't think is restricted to Chechnya at all.
No, I would fully agree. And I'm trying to understand or think through what this means when we're talking about especially authoritarian enclaves, how we should understand our local leaders and their relationship with the state. You're making the argument that what's taking place is state building. And I told you before we taped that I wouldn't go all theoretical and jargony on you and on the listeners, but I'm so curious to think about how do we know whether this is about leaders as leaders simply trying to extend their control, or how do we know if this is about state building if we think about the state as some kind of an autonomous or as an entity in a field or sphere of activity in itself?
So my thinking of state building is that it's very much a product of different political strategies that I think we can think of state building as deliberate set of strategies that a ruler pursues. And I think this is how we usually think in terms of, you know, ruler needs more taxes or they need more troops and they're trying to kind of devise different policies to strengthen their state. And for sure, this is happening and it's happened in the past. But I think to a large degree, state building or state formation emerges through political strategies and individual choices that don't have this goal of state building in mind. I think that a politician who is calling a blood revenge against a political opponent or tells the judge how to make a decision in a particular case, and also a regular person who decides to go to state court to solve their dispute with a neighbor about debt, these decisions also affect state formation, very much like this, you know, general plans of political strategists and rulers.
If I've done that and what it's done is strengthen me vis-a-vis the center, vis-a-vis the metropole, and helped me to either maintain an authoritarian enclave or helped me to limit Russia's extension into Chechnya, which may be a slightly different issue, then should I think of this as a way in which I've fended off the state, a la Jim Scott? Or should I think of this as a way in which I have strengthened the state because ultimately I'm still part of it? Do you follow me? I'm curious as to how we understand the ultimate impact of these very self-interested actions?
So my response will be probably that, you know, the state, we can talk about it in plural, or we can kind of emphasize that states are often fragmented, and you might weaken the central state, but you might strengthen your local state, and it's not necessarily kind of similar process that goes in the same direction. That especially in this context of what I call nested sovereignty, the state is fragmented and the policies and politics of the center and the periphery might very much be at odds, and it creates this complexity of state building process that strengthening of the local state does not necessarily means strengthening of the central state, and vice versa, that the center might deliberately try to weaken the state at the local level because, you know, there is a conflict between different segments of the state.
So I think that actually will help me to make sense of the ways in which you might also think about these attempts to try to strengthen the state by eliminating or strengthening state courts and state institutions vis-a-vis customary ones or vis-a-vis religious ones. So we know that there's a lot of efforts, development efforts that try to do that. And you, in a sense, are making the case that you think that at least women may be better off with the state courts than they are with some of the customary and religious courts, even in Chechnya. What do you think about these attempts? What do you think about the ideas that what you ultimately want to do if you're trying to improve people's basic welfare is to limit their use of other options and to focus their attention into state institutions?
Well, I think I have to preview the answer by saying that I think my study and, you know, research was still colored by my kind of baseline socialization and thinking about kind of in a more liberal tradition that, you know, when I came to the field, of course, for me, this was seen natural that you should solve your disputes according to state law. And that's why I was so puzzled and fascinated by people going to customary law and Sharia. And I do make a case that despite the fact that Russian state legal system in Chechnya is very corrupt, slow, and many people, you know, I never found people who were enthusiastic about Russian state law in Chechnya, I do make an argument that for women and for kind of weaker actors in social life more generally, state legal system is better because it's more rigid, kind of more bureaucratic in a way that it still follows some kind of bureaucratic inertia, while stronger actors can more easily bend non-state legal system, or in this context, customary law and Sharia, and impose restrictive, conservative interpretations of custom and Sharia. I do not claim that in general all interpretations of custom and Sharia are better for men than women. In fact, I did find some women who, large segments of women, were still embracing customary law and Sharia for ideological reasons, or they were strong believers in it. So in terms of thinking about this developmental projects, I think strengthening state law in general is a good idea. That's the area where these international experts, I think, are most at ease. So there's more understanding. But there also should be recognition that a large part of the world still lives and will continue to live under legal pluralism. And there should be a kind of deep understanding of how these systems function in order not to disrupt the balance by doing some kind of developmental projects to create more tensions or create political conflict. Because I think the most important lesson from my work is that use of state courts and non-state legal systems by politicians and by individuals have very important political implications. So any intervention that will reshuffle this balance will also change politics and distribution of power at the very local level, including in families.
So an excellent point, and I think one that extends beyond this particular issue and this particular study, right, to be a more general issue that development specialists and those who have often very good intentions, but in some ways kind of lack the complexity or an understanding of the full complexity of systems, can overlook. I'm curious, what did you find the most surprising or the most interesting finding that you had when you were in the field?
I mean, for me, in this study, almost everything was very exciting again, because, you know, I was an outsider, I was learning about a different society, living in the society. So I think basically every element, from learning about Chechen history, learning how much people care about this history, how much people care about language, and trying to explain me some of the linguistic constructs, for example, this all was fascinating. But the most important part for me was to get to know people, the families I lived with together, local social scientists who I learned a lot from. So I think these were the most valuable things. I don't think I have one silver bullet finding that I'm super excited about. Retrospectively thinking about it, I think I most value and cherish these relationships I built in the field.
And I think that comes through beautifully in the book. It's both extremely well written and really interesting, but it's also very clear how much you not only care, but how much you learned from others. And I think you do a wonderful job of being very respectful of the sources of knowledge and questions of your own positionality and others. I think it's a real model for taking those things into account and really considering who we are as researchers, how we engage with others, and really very respectfully learning from others. So again, congratulations. It's a great piece of work, and it's very fun to read and fun to talk to you about it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the episode. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you did.